Well, we finally get to get away from convention politics, whether National Alberta, Liberal Party, Tories in out west. But we're not going to get away from the character of this nation. I don't think that these conventions really address too much of that. You know, I was saddened after the Liberal convention to see the same old Liberal mantras, balanced budgets, biggest tax cuts in history. Reality was, of course, the biggest tax cuts in history took money from that they were taxing the top 3%, put it on the bottom 60%. Balanced budgets on the backs of moving pension liabilities to other ledgers and keeping UI surpluses. The Kyoto Accord, another part of the Liberal mantra, a sham, a scam for emissions trading. Everybody, including Stefan Dion, is smart enough to know what the scientists have said, that if everybody keeps 100% of Kyoto, it's a tenth of 1% of a difference. The party of the charter, the party that used big government to attack Francois Baudouin, almost destroy him for not granting loans to the BDC, the party of Paul Martin, who wiped away Section 7 charter protection rights, created the Garmy Commission just to deflect from his own problems, just to whack one part of the party wing, the party of the charter that introduced the Justice Omnibus Bill that included internet telephony and email oversight. No, that Liberal mantra is old hat. But perhaps the worst part of that mantra is Canada's place in the world. Canada is peacekeepers. Canada not as peacemakers, and God forbid that we should ever go into combat. Well, you know, that's just a lie. And that's just wrong. And it was wrong of the Liberal leaders before Dion. And it was wrong of Stefan Dion. I was disappointed to hear him talk about this in the context of Afghanistan. Well, you know, they're coming in from the Pakistani side, so we should go. No reason to be there. Fact is, and you heard it on this program from people like General Michel Gauthier, head of all our foreign commands, that Canada led a successful mission, Operation Medusa. We won. We are winning there. But somehow we don't want to engage in that. We don't want to think about that. We want to say that we're good, that we're peacekeepers. We want to say that we speak to the world with a voice of morality. And yet that voice has no moral legitimacy or authenticity because we do not engage. And we have a fear of it. It's been said it doesn't matter. It's been certainly said in Liberal circles it doesn't matter because nobody fights elections on foreign policy. Well, you know what? Maybe we should fight the next election on foreign policy because it's a question of conscience. I have to borrow a line from journalist Nathalie Grabley. She's an economist, writes a column in the Journal de Montréal, and last Thursday her column was viscerally biting. It was called "Ce n'est pas la motion qui fait la nation." It's not the motion that makes the nation, referring to the motion that was passed in the House of Commons about Quebec status as a nation. That simply saying it doesn't make it so. And one of the most compelling and acerbic comments in her column was that the most pathetic thing is the visceral need of the nationalists in Quebec to have the recognition of the other provinces of its nationhood. Not because it's merited, because they want it said. Well, Canada can no longer simply toe the Liberal line and accept that the world or Canadians should think that we're doing good in the world when we're not. This is a litmus test of what we are as a people. A motion does not make a nation, but neither do notions make nationhood. And it's important that maybe we should fight an election on foreign policy. Let's fight an election when we have a sitting prime minister who's rejected and denounced violence by jihadists and terrorists, who says we don't cut and run, who celebrates the service and sacrifice of the best of our young people. Maybe we ought to fight an election on whether Canada has learned something from America, from the best of America, from the Martin Luther Kings, who said, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Injustice to any man is injustice to every man. From John Kennedy, who said, every man's pain diminishes me. Maybe it's time that we fought an election where we decide whether Canadians are going to re-engage, as is our historic legacy, in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change, or we're going to sit around like chattering class salon liberals, patting ourselves on the back, saying, I'm all right, Jack. I just wrote a check. Maybe it's time to fight an election on the courage of where we are in the world. and to talk about one of Canada's finest hours that's continuing our stand at the United Nations with our sister democracies and against the prejudice and against the kidnapping of that organization by tin pot tyrants and dime store despots. We're going to be talking to Hillel Neuer, executive director of UN Watch, on one of Canada's brightest and shining moments that's not just a mantra, but that's something real. And we'll be right back with Hillel Neuer from Geneva right after this. About 8-9 days ago, the Human Rights Council in Geneva, that wonderful amalgam of great democracies of the United Nations that passes judgment on other countries' records of justice, presented resolutions on Darfur, which, of course, they don't want to touch. They're too busy condemning democracies. That was so bad that even the EU nations voted against it. Now, this is a council that has spent more time knocking America and voting against Israel than every other problem combined. Canada voted against the Human Rights Council's resolution then, but more importantly, just last week, there was another anti-Israel resolution presented, and Canada was the only nation voting no. Once again, this country led the way, just as it did at the Francophonie when Stephen Harper refused to go along with a one-sided motion on Lebanon and Israel. And that's what I meant in the introduction, that this is the litmus test of who we are. And to give us some background on this, we're proud to have with us again Hillel Neuer, executive director of UN Watch. Hillel, thanks for staying up so late.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Hillel, what happened on this vote? What was the vote about? And what was the importance of Canada standing alone? There are other Western countries, though America is not part of the Human Rights Council.
Last week, Canada took the lead on two critical issues. One of them was the Middle East, and the other one was Darfur. And as you mentioned, the Human Rights Council is a forum where countries such as the United States and Australia are not members. And so the question of leadership is beginning to fall on Canada's shoulders. And the question of whether the EU countries can lead reminds one of Maggie Thatcher's famous observation, Europe has no backbone. And anyone who sees the Europeans in action in the international arena and certainly at the United Nations, unfortunately sees evidence of that almost every day. The Europeans are timid, they are afraid, they want to appease the forces of totalitarianism, whether it's coming now from the Islamic group or previously from the communist sphere of influence. And so last week, once again, on the issue of the Middle East, two resolutions introduced by the Islamic group, who themselves are swept up by the forces of extremism, seeking again for the fifth and sixth time, the fifth and sixth resolution condemning Israel, whereas the entire rest of the world has been ignored. Each of these resolutions one-sided, each of these resolutions giving a cover for terrorism, seeking to demonize Israel. Canada was the only country in both resolutions that said no. Canada was the only country that said the Human Rights Council is something new and it should stand for something and shouldn't be cynically exploited. And I want to tell you that as a Canadian, I never felt prouder.
It was a remarkable moment, but not the first of Stephen Harper's remarkable moments on foreign policy. Now, I think our listeners should know that this Human Rights Council is composed of such great bastions of civility and justice as China and Cuba and Algeria, etc., etc. I think everybody gets the drift. But never are there resolutions talking about Hezbollah coverage under a civilian population and using human beings as shields. Never any resolutions of 2,000 rockets fired at Israeli civilians in the south from Gaza. Never anything condemning the Sudanese genocide of the blacks in Darfur. None of that is ever touched.
Well, let me tell you what happened today. Is that Sudan took the floor and said, Mr. Chairman, there are no violations in Darfur. It's all a lie. It hasn't been 200,000.
Who said that?
The Sudan representative.
Of course.
Said and has issued a series of 9 separate statements of quote-unquote facts and says, Mr. Chairman, it hasn't been 300,000 or 200,000 killed. It's been 9,000, and it's from all sides, and we're against the Janjaweed, and we're protecting women. I mean, the most absurd denials of the truth are said every day at the Human Rights Council, and as you mentioned, it is impossible, indeed it is rejected, any statement remotely critical of Hezbollah. There was a UN expert who deigned to look not only at Israeli actions but also at Hezbollah, and the council went ballistic and expressly rejected those statements. And so last week you had the situation where Syria, days after its gun was still smoking, of assassinating Mr. Gemayel in the government, and Syria.
Now, Hillel, they deny that.
Well, yes, they deny it, but ask anybody in Lebanon who knows the Syrians better than you and I, better than anyone.
I'm kidding. We've had the observers on, yes.
Of course. They know exactly who did it, and it's no mystery that those who oppose Syria suddenly are getting knocked off one after the other. And Syria had the temerity. Syria, the sponsor of Hezbollah, an organization that murders not only Israeli civilians, but innocent civilians in the Jewish center,
yep,
in Buenos Aires and around the world. And Syria had the temerity to condemn Israel for the fifth and sixth time on the Golan Heights, area that Syria used to use to bombard Israel, and to pretend that it was an issue of human rights. And again, on issues concerning the West Bank, not a single mention of Hamas terrorism, and to condemn Israel once again. One country said, these resolutions are not balanced. One country said, these resolutions do not belong to the Human Rights Council. One country said, we're going to say no to extremism, we're going to say yes to the principles of the Human Rights Council. That country last week was Canada.
You know, we've had Human Rights Watch and even Amnesty International who initially criticized Israel for what they called human rights violations, but then they criticized Lebanon and Hezbollah. And somehow no European country has picked up on that. There are European countries on the Human Rights Council. And, you know, where was France? Where was any of the others?
Well, in their defense, the European countries have hardly been the same as the Islamic countries as a whole. And indeed, the past summer, when a number of these resolutions were passed, Europe, to its credit, did say no. France was sort of dragged, kicking and screaming into the European consensus. But the European countries did say this is too much, and they did say no. And of course, as you know, the G8, following the Hezbollah's attack on July 12th, the G8 supported Israel. And the Europeans were not entirely with the Islamic group, but then over time their position weakens. And so these resolutions are the annual resolutions, and the Europeans are comfortable if they can find a way to condemn Israel. The settlements resolution is the one they would sponsor themselves each year. And what we saw is a regression, because 2 years ago the Europeans said, okay, we're going to condemn Israel for settlements. That's our position. But we're going to put in one line in a four-page condemnation against Israel. We're going to put in one line asking the Palestinians to take some action against terrorism. This year, they gave in. That one line is gone, and nevertheless, the Europeans signed on.
Hillel, please hang on with us. We're taking a very, very short break because I want to discuss Europe with you and Montreal, Canada. I want to hear from you. Does it matter to you what our stand is in foreign policy? Are you feeling what Hillel Noyer is, a native Montrealer, and I am feeling some pride in our Canadianism? We'll be right back. And we're talking about pride in nationhood and our foreign policy. It's a thing that matters. It makes you proud. It should make you proud that we're engaged in the world in a courageous way, that we're standing with sister democracies. And we want to hear from you. And for you cell phone users, *940 for Rogers and #940 for Bell. And we're very privileged to have with us Hillel Noyer from Geneva, Executive Director of UN Watch. Hillel, we were talking about, of course, Canada's very principled stand, being the only nation to vote against yet another anti-Israel resolution of the Human Rights Council. But we were talking about Europe and Europe's reticence in addressing this issue, even though in their domestic politics, many European nations, the Netherlands and France, and even Britain to some extent, is legislating against the menace of radical Islam and the menace of terrorism. I don't think that's too harsh a way to put it. Why can't the European nations find the same kind of courage to speak out publicly as they're doing in their internal politics, number one? And number two, do you agree with a lot of the analysts who feel that, and we've been seeing this, I'm sure you've been seeing this more and more, that Europe as we know it is gone?
Well, on the second question, that really is the big question in Europe, and there are books by Oriana Fallaci and others who are telling Europe to wake up. And it's not over yet, but there is a malaise in Europe on whether European values, European sense of freedom and liberty is something that will be defended or will slowly give way to Sharia. And in various places in France and Britain and other places.
Or the chantage amical of Sharia.
And so we're seeing all of that. Now, in terms of internal policies and disconnect with external, I'm not sure. I do know that externally, Europe is afraid. Europe is frightened. They for many years now already, they have convinced themselves that conscience is the same as interest, and they've tried to confuse the two and believe that they're convinced themselves that they're acting out of conscience when in fact they're acting out of interest. Now look at when Saudi Arabia and Libya and the other countries who control a large percentage of the world's oil reserves and control 56 UN votes, and there's no other bloc like that at the UN. Everyone needs them. They want their investment money, they want their oil, they want their UN votes. And then it's, as opposed to standing up on principle, often, too often, the choice was very obvious for many European countries. But I want to say one thing about Canada, and that's scoop, the scoop barrel, because no other Canadian media has covered this story, and I save my scoops for your show because I know that your listeners are worth it. And last week, when Canada stood up for these two resolutions, and when Canada took the lead in asking for a special session on Darfur, the Islamic group decided to punish Canada. It was a small drama of about 30 minutes, and what they did is that Canada had a resolution on freedom of opinion and two other resolutions that Canada would sponsor each year and would each year get consensus support. Suddenly, the Islamic group out of nowhere said, Mr. Chairman, we need more time. We insist that these resolutions be postponed.
I see.
And they postponed them. And I want to tell you, the Journalists Association, which has been trying to get an emblem for protecting journalists,
right,
and Canada had a paragraph for them in their resolution, saw this for what it was. It was a totalitarian moment. The Islamic group thought they were punishing Canada. In the end, they revealed themselves for who they were. It was a totalitarian moment. The Journalists Association came out and said this is a cynical exploitation of the council. And in the end, no one looked better in Canada for standing up for the values of the Human Rights Council.
Amazing. Amazing story. So freedom of opinion doesn't count for these guys. Of course, whacking Israel or any democracy does. And, you know, I'll end this conversation on this note. What always fascinates me is this excuse that is used by many in Europe. You've just mentioned it, that, well, you know, we need the Arab states because of their oil. There isn't one Arab state. There isn't one crazy guy like Chavez in Venezuela, for that matter, that doesn't do business with the West. As much as the West needs Arab oil, the Arabs need somebody to sell it to. So is it really that, or is it just that, you know, there's a certain amount of hate and jealousy involved and a lack of national will and determination?
It's all of that. It's all of that. And in the end, it falls on certain countries who have a certain tradition who are willing to stand up. And I think we're seeing it in the Harper government. It's not consistent in every respect. We wish we'd see more of it in New York. But in Geneva, we're beginning to see it.
It is the dark side versus the light side of the human character that is always fighting one another. Hillel Neuer, thank you very much for your service, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Take care. Montreal, I'll be right back. Well, today we're finally getting away from domestic politics. And we're getting back into the world. And we spent the first half hour talking about Canada's courageous stand at the Human Rights Council, being the only country to vote against yet another anti-Israel resolution, and having its own freedom of opinion resolution delayed by the Arab bloc again. What happens in the world matters. Today's International Volunteer Day, and you heard Jim Duff talking about that in his program, while Sunday's International Human Rights Day. And what Canada does in the world matters to us as a nation. It matters to us as national will, and it matters to our national character. It's time we got involved again. This prime minister is doing it, and the old mantras of the past about the good, gentle Canada doesn't cut it anymore in a new dangerous world. In the center of that danger, the center of man's last best hope, as it was called at one time, the United Nations that's been hijacked by tin pot tyrants and dime store despots. Well, the future of that organization on the East River has once again been dented a bit today with the resignation of Ambassador John Bolton. America's ambassador was straight talking. He stood up boldly to the retrograde and revanchist regimes. Much of what he had to say was very much in keeping with the spirit of what Daniel Patrick Moynihan had to say in 1976 when he said, every day at the United Nations on every side, we are assailed because we are a democracy. In the UN today, there are in the range of several dozen true free nations left. Totalitarian regimes and assorted ancient and modern despotisms make up all the rest. Nothing so unites these nations as the conviction that their success ultimately depends on our failure. And most of the new states have ended up as enemies of freedom. Our next guest, Anne Bayevsky, pulls no punches either. She's a member of the Hudson Institute. and the Touro Law Center. Founded iontheun.org, I-I-Y-E-Y-E on the UN.org. Go there. There's great stuff there, and her words burn with fire. And as she wrote today, the only winners from the resignation of Ambassador Bolton are the foes of the United States. Ambassador Bolton did a courageous job communicating and protecting American values in the belly of a beast, where those values are at risk each and every day. His commitment to real and effective reform was unshakable. And Bayevsky, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Hi.
The belly of the beast. Pretty good description. And if Moynihan said so long ago, 30 years ago, just now, that most of the new states have ended up as enemies of freedom, we can go further and say most of the new states have ended up as allies of theocratic tyrannies. Where do we go? Did Bolton just give up, or was this because he knew he wouldn't get through a democratically controlled Senate, or is this a move by America to try to placate certain voting blocks?
Well, it was a bit of a combination of those things. I mean, the president just hadn't played it very well in terms of getting his nominee approved. There was a problem at the Senate refused him at the beginning, and he had a recess appointment, they actually didn't refuse him. He didn't get an up-down vote, and they got a recess appointment. And over the following year, he did an admirable job, and there was a strong sense that he would have had majority Senate support had the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in fact, put his nomination forward. But it was a Republican, Chafee, from who refused to support him, having lost the election himself, Chafee, in the last couple of months, or last month. And his vote was key, and so it couldn't get out of committee. But the devastating part is that Bolton was almost the best ambassador the United States has ever had to the UN. Those who would rank near him were few and far between. He was, for all that was said about him, I mean, he was in fact a team player. He did what he was called upon to do, but at the same time, he demonstrated a kind of an honesty and directness that was admired by all the players. I mean, even his opponents in the UN knew where he stood and knew they couldn't get away with some of the things that they had tried and got past previous ambassadors. So he was a very unique individual, and it's a tremendous loss, which really can't be underestimated. I mean, some people say, well, they'll have another one, and the next ambassador will do whatever the president says he should do. He'll do the same old thing. John Bolton was not the same old thing. He was unique. I mean,
Stand by with us. We're just going to a short break. We'll get right back, and we're going to examine where we can see leadership, if it's possible, within the United Nations world. We'll be right back with Anne Bayevsky, iontheun.org, right after this. If you're on cell phones, *940 on Rogers, #940 on Bell, and you can email us your comments after the show at info@iepm.ca. And we're very pleased to have with us from New York, Anne Bayevsky, founder of iontheun.org. Go to this site. There's wisdom there. Remember the Hudson Institute and Touro Law Center. And we're talking about the United Nations, its future, and particularly right now the resignation of U.S. Ambassador John Bolton. And you credit Ambassador Bolton, and rightly so, with having the foresight to refuse to lend credibility to the UN Human Rights Council. And we've just been talking to Hill and Neuer in Geneva. We saw Canada, the lone voice against another anti-Israel resolution. And as Hillel pointed out, the Arab bloc tried to punish Canada by delaying the freedom of opinion resolution. Is there any future to doing any kind of common ground with any of these blocs? Or are they just going to have the old Gromyko notion of what's mine is mine, what's yours is negotiable?
No, I think what we're seeing is a sea change in the whole panoply of international human rights protection, one that Canada is beginning to understand, but that it's terribly important that sinks in. I mean, this is not the old days of the, you know, Soviet Empire, East versus West, we are seeing a revolution of despots and tyrants take over international organizations, and the UN in particular, and hijack them to the interests of, to their own interests. And, you know, it's time to stop mindless writing of checks to the UN without knowing what's coming out of these organizations. Who defeated John Bolton? It was the money of George Soros and Ted Turner's UN Foundation and Kofi Annan is the guys he left behind, mm-hmm. and some of them are going. Those are the guys who want the status quo, the corruption. It was John Bolton who was at the forefront of ending sort of gifts that they didn't have to declare, of $10,000 per person at the UN. The UN Human Rights Council, which Canada is taking a courageous stance about, imagine putting off freedom of expression till another session. I'm doing a count of the amount of time the Human Rights Council is spending on various issues. In this last 2 weeks, it's a third session, it has spent more time in Israel than any other state combined.
It has done more resolutions on Israel in its history than on everything else in the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've counted them for all those years. It's done, in particular, the Human Rights Commission, 30% of the resolutions ever adopted were on Israel alone. And there was never a resolution, not even one, on China, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and so on. But this new Human Rights Council is literally doing almost nothing but demonize Israel. And it was John Bolton who voted against it when it was adopted back in March. This council, Canada voted for that creation of the Human Rights Council. Now the world is seeing what it's those consequences, and it is time to say, to put our money where our mouth is. Why are we paying for this demonization of democratic countries? Look, Iran is on the a country that is dedicated to genocide, repeated it last week at the so-called Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, November 29th, is that's what happens at the UN. And I attended those meetings. This year, they actually showed a film which a bunch of children who were said to be hard done by the Israel security fence, no mention made of what it's for, the context, or the terrorism that it's prevented. But they had a group of children sitting in a classroom, and one of the children recites, we will sacrifice ourselves for the O Jerusalem. And so there's the UN encouraging children killing themselves for the sake of ridding the area of Jews. I mean, you have to shake your head in disbelief at what goes on there and begin to ask, what are democratic societies doing about paying for this huge, giant backward steps that are going on before our eyes?
A moral resort area for decadence. One's reminded that in 1898, Victor Adler at the Social Democratic Congress in Vienna said, anti-Semitism will die with the last Jew. And be patient with us. I just want to release some pressures off the lines. We'll take one caller. Carol, good evening.
Hi, Beryl.
You're on
long
with Ann Bayevsky.
Long time no speak, but I'm always listening.
Good, thank you.
I'm Carol from NDG. I just want to tell you about the human rights, but you know, I was thinking, okay, human rights to other countries, it's all very nice, but human rights starts right here. When we think of our own Quebec government keeping those law allocation logement just for the 55 years old and over and the ones who have kids, and what about the ones who have no kids that are not yet 55? Some of them won't even have heating this winter.
Well, Carol, we've covered those topics in shows before, and as I said to you, and as I say on this show
we'll
so many times,
enough.
If we don't engage ourselves truly on social justice abroad, it's going to wither and die in the vine here at home, and that's part of it. Thanks for calling in. And the mindset of leadership, you know, Canada just got a new Liberal Party leader right out of the gate. He started with the Liberal mantra about Afghanistan, and, you know, the Democrats are making their noises in the States. And as you said, people like George Soros who are opposed to Bolton, and a lot of the common sense, I'm not even going to call it anything else. These are not stupid people. Who do they think they're going to do business with on the world stage? You know, I've had a rhetorical question out there to Jack Layton, who wanted to have a conversation with the Taliban. And my rhetorical question is, Jack, what do you want to talk to them about? Whether they shoot you as a socialist or cut your throat as a trade unionist? What is in these people's minds when you talk about guys like Soros and Turner?
Well, I don't know. It's a kind of almost a disease of the liberal mindset. And I mean, one can be pro-human rights without being foolhardy and know when and understand your enemy. And I think the challenge is that our enemies, the enemies of democracy and freedom, have taken over the United Nations. They have the numbers. The Human Rights Council is only one example of that, where of the 47 members, the majority is from the African and Asian regional groups. The Organization of the Islamic Conference took over the African and Asian regional groups, so they control the balance of power. That's how the game is played. And at the UN General Assembly, you have 192 countries. 132 of them are from the developing world. Of those, they're largely controlled by the so-called non-aligned movement, which held its last meeting in Cuba to talk about, in quotation marks, human rights. So we have to understand that we're outnumbered, the war which is being imposed upon us is both, it's not just physical, but it's mental. We have to, our values are at risk, and if we don't do something to protect them, we'll suffer the consequences.
Ann Bajewski, iontheun.org. Thank you very much for being with us. And as speaking for the Institute, we hope to have Ann Bajewski up here for a conference very shortly, as shortly as we can organize it, and as shortly as her schedule will allow for it. And if you want to hear a compelling voice for reason, it's Ann Bajewski. And Ann, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Take care. We'll be right back after this. And we've been talking about foreign policy tonight. That is a litmus test of our peoplehood. That is a litmus test of our courage, of our conscience, of our character. It matters. It should matter to you. There are brave people out there, like Hillenure in Geneva, like Ann Bajewski in New York. They're manning the ramparts of freedom. We can't afford just to sit behind our borders and feel cozy. Before we go, we're going to take a little bit of the pressure off the lines. Andy, welcome.
Good evening. Hello?
Good evening.
Yeah, listen, I cannot have anything against any of your guests. They said the right thing. Unfortunately, the Chamberlains of 2006 are still alive. But there is the suggestion, why is there no counter force in a sense of bringing out among the countries, among the people, what's actually happening? Because
Andy, there are the Hillenures in Geneva, the Ann Bajewskis in New York. Our own prime minister is giving us an example. He doesn't care if he has to stand alone. Do you understand how incredibly courageous it was?
Look, as far as the prime minister, with the exception of the Quebec Nation bit, I said to myself, at the next election, I'm going to vote conservative, because I'm telling you, this guy has more guts than all the other prime ministers we ever had. But this worldwide, by the way, there's going to be the Europeans will get their own lesson very soon. You know why?
Tell me.
Because in Lebanon, we're going to have a civil war. And those European nations who are holding up the peace, they're going to get it. Because the people who are against them are over there. So Germany, France, and the Italians, all of these people who are not doing anything, are unwilling to speak up, they're going to get it in the back. And unfortunately, there are going to be losses in human lives. I don't wish for a civil war, but till the West, the democratic West, the freedom-loving, we're not perfect, but there is, among all the nations, the United States, Israel, Great Britain, and a few others. They are willing to say how things are, but it's not enough just to say it. You should put pressure on, not by non-government agencies, but there are ways of fighting back, even verbally, that would disgrace these people.
You gotta walk the walk, not just talk the talk.
But the thing is this, when I talk, most people are...
Not you, a leader of a nation.
Yeah, the leader of the nation. But it's one thing, I'll tell you, I have so many suggestions, but as soon as I open my mouth, people run away from me. By the way, I was trying to put your put the office boy from the Department of Defense on... I was going to give him a little lecture. You didn't let me last week.
Lieutenant General. He's the general of our foreign forces and a great hero. Andy,
just
thanks.
An office boy.
Not quite, Andy. Not quite. He was the commander of Operation Apollo, the largest military operation, among other things, that Canada's done since Korea. Hardly that. Andy, it's been good talking to you. We're out of time for the show.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Canada, Montreal. Alexander Tyler, the Scottish historian, said that nations have cycles. Free nations have cycles. They go from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance, sadly, to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependence, and from dependence back into bondage. It is the responsibility of this generation, and I don't think that our generation will change places with any other in the history of mankind, but it is our obligation to make sure that we will rage against the dying of the light and never go gently into that night of bondage again. Thanks to Nick Mays and Master Control. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.